Hi everyone, I'm Grace.
And I'm Max.
Welcome to Curiously Enough. This is a space to shine a light on the shadows we hide in. This is a conversation to relieve the heaviness of silenced topics. Here's to getting honest and getting real, feeling inspired and less alone. Thank you for joining us on this road to rediscovering the truth of who we are.
Please subscribe and share. We're grateful for your support. Enjoy this week's episode of Curiously Enough.
We are so excited to welcome our guest for today, Sarah Delaney. Sarah is the founder of African Healing Exchange. African Healing Exchange is a nonprofit with a mission to end the cycle of generational trauma and related physical, social, and emotional dysfunction, including addiction and substance abuse, by providing resilience training to the most vulnerable people with a history of trauma. They teach life coping skills to women and families to help end the emotional suffering so their clients can meet their own basic needs, find self-love, and in turn raise healthy children who are free from their ancestors' burdens. Sarah has been working with Rwandans since 2007. After watching a film about the 1994 Rwandan genocide, Sarah was called to learn from the women who had lost nearly everything. She thought, if they can still find a reason to live, so can I. In serving others, Sarah finds purpose, and she has committed her life to helping others access resources that were once offered to her. She has degrees in business management, French, and nonprofit development, with specialized training in cross-cultural training, leadership and change, and sustainable development. Sarah is based in Asheville, North Carolina with her family and spends as much time as possible in Rwanda.
If you would like to learn more about Sarah, please visit healingexchange.org or threemountains.org. Sarah, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Yes, thank you for being here. We're going to get right into it, if you don't mind. Could you just maybe start off by telling us and our audience a little bit more about your story prior to this connection with Rwanda?
Sure. Thank you both for having me today. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Us too.
Yeah, well, what a great introduction. I mean, you covered a lot there, and you mentioned that I've been working with people in Rwanda since 2007. Even before I made it to Rwanda, I was really, really inspired by the stories of women that I heard about, that I watched movies about, I read about, who had survived the genocide, which took place in 1994. So in 94, I was still in high school, and I actually don't remember hearing anything about the genocide. It wasn't until 6 years later, I was about 22, that I watched a movie about the genocide. And I watched it at a time in my life that I was really, really struggling. I was just out of college. I had this kind of life that looked, you know, I looked really put together on the outside. I had a very good job. I had done well academically in college. You know, I had a lot of opportunities, and I was born into, you know, relatively privileged middle-class family in Vermont. I went to a great college in Boston. But the thing is, I was just feeling really, really lost. And I was feeling, at that point, I didn't realize it, but I was living with post-traumatic stress disorder. It hadn't been diagnosed, but I was living in a state of freeze, and that's a very common response to trauma. So by the time I watched this movie about the Rwandan genocide, I was pretty numbed out. I was checked out, and I was living this life during the day, and then at night I was blacking, you know, I was drinking until I blacked out. I was drinking alcoholically, and I was pretty unhappy. But the stories of these women and the resiliency that I could feel in the power of their stories of survival, not just survival, but like still finding this reason to live, as you said in the introduction, just inspired me so much. And it gave me a sense of hope. And that was, I think, when probably the most significant seed was planted. And I had this deep feeling that I was meant to go to Rwanda one day. And it wasn't so much that I thought I could help, anyone else. It was that I thought maybe in going there, I would have some help for myself and learn about what this spirit of resilience was. And that's actually the tagline for my company, Three Mountains Now.
Mm. So powerful. And thank you for being vulnerable in your story. I know that it's difficult even after years of, you know, like you experience what you experience, but still sharing your story, there comes a point where, I don't know, we learn how to tell it with healing involved. And so I appreciate you bringing that up. And also just the connection you made with Rwanda and your own story and potentially finding, as I mentioned, like your own healing by going there and connecting with the people and the land maybe and the culture, which would kind of, I'm curious, you had this inclination that this was something that was meant for you. How did that transition begin? What led you there? How did you get there? What was the first steps before even creating what you've created now, this like empire of healing for others?
Right. Well, before I backtrack, I just, as you were talking, I remember there was this very powerful experience I had when I first got to this, the Western province in Rwanda, and I'll tell you how I got there in a little bit, but I'm driving with, you know, my guides and friends up this very rocky mountain, and we're driving up to this, the top of this mountain, which used to be a volcanic mountain, and it's overlooking Lake Kivu. You can see the Democratic Republic of Congo across the water, and it's just this amazing landscape. And in my body, it was like every cell in my body felt like I was going home. I felt like I was getting ready to see, you know, if you've ever been away from family for a long, long time, right? I felt like I was about to reunite with my family, and I'd never been there, you know, and it was just this very incredible sense of belonging, a sense of peace, a sense of excitement, and a sense of safety, which a lot of people find that to be so ironic, you know, in a land that was once so violent and so just covered in blood. Like I felt like I was where I was meant to be. And I still have that feeling when I go back now. And I say that because, you know, that was so profound for me, because I grew up feeling incredibly uncomfortable in my skin. I felt like I didn't belong in this world. I, you know, even though I had a nice home, it didn't feel like home. So, you know, that was the first time. I mean, when I finally made it to Rwanda, I was, I think 30, 31. And that was, you know, probably the first time I felt like really at home in this world. Mm-hmm. So the, you know, the reason I do what I do is, and I don't feel that way every day still, right? It's still work to feel that, but I've had a good solid taste of it. And so the reason I do what I do is because I want to give others the opportunity to feel that as well. And so there was a time that, especially when I was in, you know, active alcoholism and living that life, I didn't even have a chance, you know, of tuning in to what that felt like. So, you know, when I saw that movie and I had that sense that one day I needed to go to Rwanda, I knew that I had to get sober first. I knew I had to get healthy. I knew, you know, I had to be safe and in like good physical, mental health before I made that kind of trek. So I spent a good part of my 20s on that path of really, you know, working on getting sober, working on, you know, taking the first steps in recovery, and starting to do the work that I, you know, that I would eventually do for the rest of my life. So by the time I hit 30, I had moved down to Asheville, North Carolina, and I was, you know, starting to do really well and feeling better in the world. And I had a cool job. I had gone back to school. I got my master's in nonprofit development. I studied leadership and change. I studied psychology of business. And I was just really, really determined to create an organization that would help bridge the divide between the nonprofit and the business sector. I've always been very entrepreneurial, and I felt like there was this great opportunity to create a business that could do some really, really great things in the world. And so I started working in fair trade. I became a fair trade activist, and my first job out of grad school was for a fair trade clothing company. And then I moved down to Asheville, and I was the nation's first national coordinator for Fair Trade Towns USA, which still exists today. It's a lot bigger now. And from there, I started corresponding with a coffee farmer in Rwanda by email. So this was like 2007. And it was this Rwandan president of a farmer-owned coffee cooperative, and his name was Mr. Emmanuel. And I spoke French, and we started this very kind of simple correspondence by email. I was inquiring about his coffee farm and really impressed that they were pursuing organic certification and fair trade certification. And I was compelled to know, was the fair trade system better for him? Was it better for the farmers? Or was it just something that we American consumers, you know, were hoping was making a positive impact in the world? So that, you know, that was another big seed that was planted. He encouraged me to come to Rwanda and see for myself. So that was kind of the next step of like, okay, I'm getting closer to Rwanda here. I know someone there now, you know. Mm. And then I think within like 6 or 8 months, this crazy thing happened where I got this email, and it was like a job application inquiry, or it was like an invitation to apply for this job. And the job was for a couple to move to Rwanda and run this business while the founders were out of the country having a baby. And then they listed off the qualifications for each person. And one of them, it was just like to a T. It was almost designed for me. And at the time, I was married to someone who fit the bill for the other person. And, you know, within 30 days, we were interviewing by Skype, and we got the job, and we found, I mean, it all just happened really seamlessly. And it was just meant to be. It flowed really well. And by January, we arrived January 20th. It was the night of President Obama's inauguration speech. We arrived on Rwandan soil and lived there for almost a year.
Wow. What an amazing story. and I guess I want to backtrack a little bit by saying, I love the fact that you bring up your intuition and kind of, you know, I have a friend of mine who I've been close with for some time who always told me, your gut is God, and God can mean whatever, but you know, when you feel called to do something, do it. You know, if it feels right, go for it. And I love the fact that, you know, this kind of was something that came out of the blue. You saw this movie, you had some experiences, and nothing really got in the way of you like saying, this is ridiculous, or this is just a random thought that popped in my head. Like you had this experience and you went for it. And I love that. And I also love that piece of, you know, people who might be affected by addiction or mental health or trauma or just ordinary people, this desire to have connection. And I almost want to even take that out of the addiction or mental health, because no matter who you are and where you come from and what your circumstances, as a human being, we all want connection. And I think, you know, you having these various experiences and coming to believe that, you know, there's this vision of going to Rwanda, like that is what you felt called to do. You felt connected to that and you went for it. And I just wanted to highlight that because I think that's such an important piece in all of this. But also coming from a different standpoint, I am very curious that, you know, did you have any false beliefs or preconceived judgments when you started to make your way over to Rwanda, because it's, you know, that's just a different country with different people and a different culture. And it's just, it's a whole different experience. So I was curious if any of that took place in the beginning stages of you making this big transition?
Yeah, that's a good question. And sometimes I forget, you know, because I've been going there for so long now. It seems so easy to me because it's like home to me. And I forget what a big, like what a big difference it is for people when they first go there. And yeah, a lot of people want to know, like, is it safe? And just asking about the climate and the topography. And, you know, I have this bumper sticker on my fridge that says Africa is not a country. And I definitely did not learn much about the continent of Africa when I was a kid in school in the States. And I don't think many children do. I know some schools here in Asheville that actually have a course on African history, which is great. But sadly, even people I've talked to in East Africa, even the children there are learning more about U.S. history than their own country's history, which is really sad to me. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, that's probably a result of colonialization. And I think, you know, a lot of assumptions are made about Africa in general or Africans in general. And so I'm still learning. I mean, I'm human. I still make assumptions. I still carry stereotypes about other people or see, you know, having this like us, them mentality. And so I really discourage that and just try to catch ourselves when we use terms like us and them, or, you know, in building Africa Healing Exchange, my real like core belief about how it could be so unique and successful compared to some other NGOs and charity models is that this idea of an exchange where we're creating this equal, you know, level playing field and platform for this bilateral cross-cultural exchange where it's not an us and them. It's not a, you know, Western civilization helping people in the global South. It's not about third world or first world, black and white. But I do know that, you know, those are very serious issues to look at. It's a very complex history. And so, you know, that said, Rwanda is very different, for example, from its neighboring countries, like the Great Lakes region of East Africa includes Uganda, Burundi, Kenya, Rwanda, Congo, and Rwanda is the size of Vermont, the state that I grew up in, but there are about 12 million people, so it's one of the most densely populated countries in the world. So I was concerned it would feel really crowded. I grew up in the country and I was concerned that there'd be people everywhere. And I'm also an introvert. So I thought, you know, am I ever going to have time by myself? I was never afraid of like feeling safe. I think partly because the people who hired me to move to run their business, they were American and we had a lot of conversations and they actually talked about their quality of life in Rwanda being better than their quality of life in the U.S. And they were originally from San Francisco and Manhattan. So Wow. They had pretty nice lives in the U.S. and their background was public health. And so I was, you know, we were pretty set up when we moved there. It was a pretty easy transition. The country is incredibly gorgeous. Like it's high elevation, so it's perfect weather, cool at night, warm during the day, very green, mountainous, and the whole like densely populated thing. It's really most of the people there are farmers. I think about 80% of the country. They're growing their own food. And so most of the land is being cultivated, but it doesn't feel crowded. It's just that everyone has their own little plot of land. And then the capital of Kigali is a really livable city. I mean, it's just, there's nice homes. There's, you know, great places to eat. Everything's organic and you can get clean water everywhere. The healthcare system is good. So, I mean, that says a lot for a nation that in 1994 was almost completely destroyed. I mean, in 100 days, 1 million, almost 1 million people were killed. Hmm. That's Rwandans killing Rwandans. And it was one of the most violent acts in the world's history. And it didn't just start overnight. It wasn't just 100 days. It was, you know, obviously there was a lot of buildup, and then after that, I mean, everything was destroyed. The businesses, the natural habitat, the animal population. So that's not very long that the country's had to rebuild itself. It's pretty amazing when you go there today.
And I think it's funny too that, like, you know, when I hear Rwanda, for example, you know, when I hear somebody talk about that, or I look it up in a book, or I see it on the news, like, instantly I do have preconceived judgments. And then here I am talking to somebody who's been there, lived there, done work there, and it's like, yeah, that's nothing like how the media or other things may portray it. You know, it's just like when I think, like, oh yeah, I know what that word means, and then I like look up the definition and it's nothing like what I thought it was.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that's just kind of like, I don't know, we don't mean to be ignorant, but many of us are, as to what other countries are like and what the life there, the lifestyle is like, which is part of what's so neat about having you on, is to shine light on not only that, but the reality, like the struggles that are there that maybe, again, we may be ignorant to. We think the struggles are completely different and have more to do with, oh, do they have water? Do they have food? And really what you're bringing to the table is there's trauma. Let's like, yeah, maybe food and water is part of that. I don't know much about, you know, again, I'm learning as you speak with us, but I would love for you to touch on that, because I think that is what people perhaps would need to know more of. And also there's, I mean, we'll get into it, but there's so much that you're doing that is, whether it's in the US or Rwanda, it needs to be happening. Mm-hmm. So I'd love for you to kind of talk about the creation of Africa and Healing Exchange, and whether you answer it in this question or we kind of get to it, but I know there's a community resilience model and like the integration with that, just explaining what the heck that is and why it's so important, because we're fascinated. So yeah, the floor is yours.
Sure. Okay. Well, so I have an office in downtown Asheville, and I have an 8-year-old son, and there are some shelters and food kitchens near my office. And I remember the other day my son asked why people were living that way. Like, why were they kind of curled up on the sidewalk? And he has been asking a lot about addiction lately. And so we've been exploring this topic of mental health and, you know, how people get to that point. And I'm definitely not an expert in that field, but just to, you know, just to look at this as a universal problem, right? It's like, why can't some people meet their own basic needs? And why, like, what is the real root problem of that? You know, why don't they have access to clean water? Like, why don't they have access to resources? Why can't they maybe earn a living to take care of their children and put food on the table? So it's more of a very complex universal problem that we need to look at. And I know that there's a lot of organizations and charities, and their heart's in the right place, but I often see these efforts at trying to do like the Band-Aid approach or the quick fix, or, you know, buy something and someone gets something for free, or, you know, sponsor a child, or these efforts where it seems like it might be helping, but it's really short-sighted. And so what I've learned, and I'm not a psychologist, but I work with a lot of professionals in that field, and in creating this resiliency model, I've learned a lot about how trauma impacts the body and the brain, and how we store those memories in our cells, in the DNA, and how it affects our day-to-day functioning. And I've seen some studies that show behind most addiction is some kind of trauma. So this is where, you know, the cycle is happening that we need to break. We need to break it for the next generation. We need to offer resources for people to heal their own, become their own healers. One of my colleagues in Rwanda talks about that is we're teaching each other to become our own healers. And that's what the resiliency model is about that we're creating. It's uncovering our inherent, the wisdom that our body was born with. And we all have these tools within us. Like the human body is amazing. And unfortunately, you know, or fortunately, I don't know, some people we're born in different circumstances. We have different experiences. Some people are thrown into a place of not being able to really function or take care of themselves, while other people have the same experience maybe, and they go on to thrive. There's this thing called post-traumatic growth, which I think is just incredibly inspiring. So we hear about PTSD. I think that impacts maybe 25% of trauma survivors, where post-traumatic growth or PTG actually is even more prevalent. So that's what I like to look at is like, let's share these stories about overcoming all these, you know, horrible things and going on to thrive and going on to help other people. Mm. And part of the model in Rwanda that we're right now really focused on is our entrepreneurship training. So after we offer the resiliency training and we help people get stabilized, then they're able to build businesses or further develop the business that they have or find other ways to earn income and become more sustainable, become more independent economically. And so part of this whole model is financial healing too. So in teaching people entrepreneurship skills and in offering support for businesses that we're building in Rwanda, we're also giving people the opportunity to help others. And so this is much different where a lot of models are, we help, 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 you know, where the recipient, it's just not empowering, right? Like the person, like, and we know this in recovery too, it's the sponsorship model. Like we can't keep, I mean, in the 12-step program, we learn that we can't keep what we don't give away. So we've got to have the opportunity to be of service to someone else in order to really, really have that full circle healing experience.
Absolutely. And I'm so grateful that you bring up the Band-Aid approach, because that's something that I definitely am becoming more aware about. And, you know, I went to school for social work, so I started to learn a little bit about, you know, what our society looks like and what services are being provided. And just, I'll speak for myself because addiction is what I know best. Just last year, 23 million Americans meet the criteria for a substance use disorder.
Oh, wow.
And only 4 million people got services.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it really makes you look at, is the system working? And I love how you brought up, there are a lot of people out there making a difference, but are they coming from the Band-Aid approach? Or are they really willing to take the time to listen to that person's story, to recognize the resiliency piece? And it's just so incredibly important. And I guess saying all that and hearing everything you had to say, you know, are we missing something with the PTSD piece? Like, is there something that we can do better, mm-hmm. better serve?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one thing I've learned about trauma and for someone who's diagnosed with PTSD, and I can tell you this from personal experience, that an experience I had when I was 21, I was doing a semester abroad, I was in France, and someone, a man, I don't know who it was, I never saw his face, broke into my hotel room and raped me. And that experience sent me into a state of freeze. And today, it's almost 20 years later, and I'm I'm actually doing a lot of work on this experience now. I thought I had done the work, but it turns out I have a ways to go, because even 2 decades later, it's like sitting on my shoulder. And I didn't realize how much this was affecting my day-to-day life. I really didn't, because it was almost like I'd gotten so used to it. I think it's like if someone's kind of sick with something over time, you know, they almost don't even realize until they feel better. And it's like, oh God, how did I live with that for so long? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that was the experience that really had me on my knees and like really had me, you know, trying to just kind of check out of life when I learned about the genocide. And so now when I talk to someone in Rwanda, for example, who is a genocide survivor, and they're telling me their story, and I'm hearing it like it happened yesterday. And now I understand, because trauma knows no time. It doesn't matter how, you know, time actually does not heal everything. That saying is not accurate. It heals everything if we have the resources to heal, but just time alone doesn't. So for someone who's had a capital T trauma experience, because there's all kinds of trauma, you know, there's complex trauma, there's little T, big T, and not to compare, but there's different types. If someone's living with that untreated post-traumatic stress disorder, it doesn't matter how long ago it was. But what I'm finding is no matter what kind of trauma it was, no matter how long ago it was, we all have the ability to overcome it and heal from it as long as, and this is my belief, as long as we have community support and we have access to effective resources. So what I've experienced is a lot of Americans don't have the community support. They might have access to resources. They might have money. They might have some free government services. They might have, you know, facilities and centers around town that can help. But we are feeling increasingly alienated and isolated and separate and lonely. And there's so much that we can do to survive day to day in this country without even interacting with anyone, right? Like we don't even have to leave our house anymore. Everything can get delivered. We can do even our work, our everything we could do alone at home. And the big difference, what I get so much out of when I go to Rwanda, is this sense of community and this idea that it takes a village and you're never alone. But it's not this like overwhelming, like I can't get any time to myself. It's this like beautiful embrace. It's like this most just total acceptance, like unconditional love, like big warm hug, like Mama Africa nurturing. And you're never alone. Like if someone's having a problem and there, you know, there are people there to help. You know, someone's getting married and maybe they don't have money for the wedding, the neighborhood pitches in. They all put it together. It's beautiful. So, I mean, but they don't, you know, after the genocide, they had, I think, 4 psychologists in the whole country. So they didn't have access to effective resources, but they had community support. In this country, maybe we have access to effective resources, but not community support. And, you know, in some cases, we do have both. And I think that's where the sustainable recovery and success stories of people moving out of poverty are different.
Wow. And thank you for, again, being vulnerable with your story. I was very moved by the way you discussed it and the wording you used. And I think just, again, to highlight the one portion of what you said about the fact that time doesn't always heal. And specifically when we're talking about trauma, whether, like you said, little T, big T, if it's a culmination of tiny traumas together, or if it's a big, intense trauma, regardless, our body, going back to what you mentioned even earlier, our body is so smart and it remembers so much. And so you know, going through the motions day to day, not thinking it's affecting us. Our body is remembering because our body knows no time. It just is. And so an old trauma feels like it's happening now because our body, that's the way it operates. And so I think that's something that if you're reading about trauma or learning or even healing your own wounds in therapy or psychiatry or however, whatever work that looks like, you may know this, but I think a lot of people don't know it. And so PTSD is this term that we're just like, if you have no experience with it or someone close to you, or you haven't read about it, it becomes very overwhelming. Really, it's simple and yet not at the same time, but the way that you described it is very simple. Our body remembers, and it takes both community and effective resources to heal that. And it's very possible. And it's so, I was going to ask you, and you answered the question about the community in Rwanda. And I assumed that is what you were going to say, how powerful and inspiring and loving that is, and how interesting that you can come back here and see the difference. That we are very isolated. We stay in our homes. Max and I recently read an article just about the rising suicide and overdose rates, specifically with millennials, and how a big part of that could be that we aren't as inclined to participate in like church events or religions. Like I don't know, this is just based on the article and kind of our own experience, but a lot, we're seeing more of millennials not identifying with religion. And so I wonder how much that has to do with it, you know, just beliefs, whether it's politics. So anyway, I'm on a tangent, but you just bring up a lot of great points.
Yeah. And I know I'm going to be repeating myself, and I've mentioned this on a few episodes now, but you know, that isolation piece, and we've heard it through other people that we've talked to, is that isolation is actually the new drug of choice. Yes, we have an opioid problem. Yes. There's a lot of suicide happening, and you know, all that is definitely taking place in our society, but the overarching theme is isolation.
Yeah.
And I can't thank you enough for bringing up that community base. And I know there's 12 steps. I know there's other group formats and fellowships, and there are things that are in place. But when you really look at the healing process, and that if you want to seek some sort of help, there are tons of psychiatrists, tons of therapists, tons of professionals in that arena, and it is definitely important. But what about the community aspect? Are we matching that from a community point of view? So thank you for sharing that. And I think, you know, hearing about all of your experiences, you've gone to school and have all these different degrees, and you've been through things personally in your own journey, you know, is there a main message you're trying to share or want to share with everyone and anyone?
Wow. Well, you know, I talk a lot about Rwanda and people, you know, I know Rwanda is not for everyone. Most people are never going to make it there. But really, this is, you know, it for me, it was finding myself in doing the work that I do in Rwanda. And I just encourage everyone to find what that is if they haven't already. And it doesn't matter what you do, or it doesn't have to be building an organization or traveling the world. You know, there's so many amazing things we can do within our own home, within our own family, being of service in our own family. And so I just really, I know what it feels like not to have that sense of direction and meaning. And I was completely lost. I mean, I was on my knees. I was, you know, I knew that if I kept going the way I was going, I wouldn't make it past my 33rd birthday. I knew it. And look at, you know, my life is, if I had known what my life would look like now, I would not have felt so hopeless, you know? And so for anyone out there listening, I just encourage you to not lose hope, to look for the light. Sometimes it's just a small flicker. But I know that everyone out there can find that thing too. And just definitely know that you're not alone.
Hmm. Thank you. And I fully agree. I think, especially when we're talking about even isolation, just to link it back, like, I think a lot of that comes from not knowing what direction we're going to, or I don't know my purpose. And it doesn't have to be, just like you said, creating an organization. It can be as simple as, like, these are the things that matter to me. Mm. And I think just finding that, but unfortunately, or fortunately, like, it takes some work and some action to get there, to say, this is what matters to me. This is important. This is fun. This is how I bring service in my home. This is how I make people feel good about themselves, to onto bigger things of, this is what I want to do 5 days a week, or this is where I want to go during these 3 months of my life every single year, or whatever that looks like. It is a, you know, we talked with someone on a previous podcast about exploring, and that term, what that means, to go inward so that you can figure out externally what that looks like. And that's a journey in itself. So I appreciate you sharing that.
If I could just add, you know, I feel like a lot of people maybe don't pursue the thing because it seems too big. It seems overwhelming, right? And I think, mm-hmm. like, I meet people every day who are just so busy, right? That's like the most common thing to say now. I am so busy, no matter what, like, working people, retired people, like, everyone just seems so busy. But if we can just do one thing today, like, take one step in that direction, take one step towards the dream, towards the goal, whatever it is, that's good enough. You know, that's good enough for today. And focus on, you know, if what you want to do is be of service or help someone else, like, and you think, oh, but look at the world, like, there's so much need, where do I even begin? Just focus on one person, one thing, because mm-hmm. that's where, you know, that's where it starts to build. And like, when I think about, you know, all the work there is to do, sometimes it's like, I think about one face. I think about one woman who makes me smile every time I see her in Rwanda. We're growing, we have a small farm there now. We're growing medicinal herbs. It's called the Ubuzima Healing Garden. And I did this vision board, like, mapped it out a couple years ago, and it just came out. There was this garden, and we were growing, like, tulsi and oshra and lemongrass. And it's happening now. It happened, you know, slowly or fast, I don't know, but it's happening. We're growing this. We introduced oshra to Rwanda. Mm. And people are coming now, like, just walking by the farm because it smells so good. They're calling it, they're like, just walking by, they feel less stressed. Mm. And, you know, I don't know how that happened, but we just focused on, well, let's plant a little bit of tulsi. Let's do this. Like, just, you know, focus on one thing, one person, start small.
Yeah. And as far as the time piece goes, like, oh, I don't have enough time, or there's so much going on. That is definitely true for a lot, if not most people. But if you go on your iPhone and you look at that little app that tells you, like, how much time you spend on each, you know, platform, I guarantee, like, for me, because this used to be an excuse, I look at, like, that app and I spent like an hour on Facebook and 45 minutes on Instagram. You like, that time could be used elsewhere, you know? Yeah. So
it's an excuse, but it isn't.
Right.
And if it matters, then you make time.
That's right.
And I think that's a hard, tough love kind of thing, but it's true. And I grew up and I kind of had to reframe this phrase, because for a while I didn't like the wording, but like, you have to make sacrifices. Mm. And it doesn't have to look like you're crying through, like, oh my gosh, I can't hang out with my friends ever again, you know, but that's something I continue to learn, is like, well, what am I willing to replace? Mm. What can I change about, you know, now we're getting into like time management, but I think it's important when we're talking about like going after your dreams or your deepest desires, like, it's okay that things are going to be funky at first. And finding your footing. And one thing I think that when you were talking about, like, just take that first step, another thing I think we've even learned just with this podcast or just in other areas of our life, and that we, I'll speak for myself, but I'm sure Max will agree, that we continue to learn, is like, the first steps that you take, they're not going to look that different once you get going and continue to work on whatever you're working on or whatever you're creating. You're just going to keep doing that same thing over and over again. You know, like for this podcast, we just keep contacting people and recording podcasts. Like, it doesn't look much different than in the beginning, but when you think of your vision, it's so overwhelming because it's like, how, what the heck is between point A and point B? It's really just the same thing that is at point A. It's not that. So I just wanted to touch on that because it,
Right. It's like getting started. Like my son on Saturday, we bought this box. It was like a Tyrannosaurus Rex fossil kit. I don't know how many, like hundreds of tiny pieces this thing. And so I bought it for him and I'm like, don't expect me to help you with this. Like, this is not my cup of tea. But over the course of the weekend, he finished it last night, he built this like this amazing fossil replica of a Tyrannosaurus Rex. But I'll tell you what, the first step was so hard. Like, all these pieces are spread out in front of him. He doesn't know where to start. It took a while, you know, and I helped him sort it and I sat with him. I didn't help him build it. And, but once he got the first layer done, it started flowing. Like, it, the momentum was building, and then got, you know, by the time he was halfway into it, he was on a roll. And I think that he kept saying the first step was the hardest. I'm like, yeah, that's with everything. So true, buddy.
Yeah. Very wise. And as far as, you know, as we're talking about like dreams and visions and even vision boards and the creation of what your life is now and what you continue to work on, did you have any moments where, you know, because we're talking about resilience here, so I'm sure you've personally experienced resilience and continue to do so, but were there moments where you felt like giving up, or maybe the comments or opinions of other people of doubt came in? So did any of that come up? What did that look like?
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't say doubts, but I've definitely had periods of time where I felt alone. You know, I felt alone with this big idea. I felt alone with this big vision and afraid, like afraid that if I pause or slow down, it's just all going to fall apart, you know? But then I remember it's really not about me. Like, I'm just serving as, if I can listen to that divine guidance, I'm just really serving as this vessel. And, you know, I love this idea that, God, you know, God's providing the direction and everything. We're just rowing the boat. And so when I remember that, it gives me more faith that, that this is, you know, we're heading in the right direction. But I definitely have been like super impatient at times about how long it takes. I get frustrated with fundraising at times. You know, I think everyone who works in the nonprofit sector probably has said that, but that's part of the reason I started Three Mountains, to serve as a social enterprise to support the work of Africa Healing Exchange, because I really desire to create the most sustainable model as possible. And like I said before, you know, that next level of healing really comes with economic independence, and that sense of self-empowerment. Like, we're not empowering other people, we're empowering ourselves by creating what we desire. And so that's where Three Mountains comes in here. And that's been an incredible, like, gift in my life. It's we're going on 3 years now, so we're still a startup business. We just launched 2 product lines this year. So I'm using that platform to really help tell the story of inspiration and resilience of Rwanda, and selling fair trade organic tea products. We just launched Silverback, which is a non-alcoholic carbonated tea using Rwandan tea leaves, and that just came out in cans the past couple of months. So as I do all that, I definitely get voices and people come into my life who are like, are you sure, you know, you're not doing too much? Like, and I used to take that personally, like, oh, maybe I'm doing too much. Like, maybe this is too big. Maybe I don't have what it takes. Like, there was that insecurity that would creep in, but luckily, you know, it didn't pull me down. And I found, you know, over time, it's so important that we stay really close to, you know, the people who, you know, we can lift up together, the people who lift us, lift our visions up and hold space for what we know, you know, what we know to be our path. But, you know, there's also some wisdom and truth in that, like, cautioning, like, wait a sec, like, you know, let's make sure that I'm really focused here, that we have the resources to do these things really well, and I don't get spread too thin, and that I take my own advice and practice some self-care and don't get, you know, too busy, you know, that I don't have time for what's most important, which is my family and taking care of my own recovery so that I can still be of service to other people around the world.
Mm. Yeah. And I think that is the balance, and you kind of just noted it at the end, between what matters as far as family and then work you do and then yourself. There's a lot of moving parts, but you said it beautifully and very well. But to wrap it up.
Yeah. And I just want to say real quick too, that if no one has caught on, Sarah pretty much does everything. So you're a rock star, and my hat goes off to you with all the work that you do. And Grace and I are beyond grateful that you took time out of your day to talk to us. And we'd love to just wrap this up by asking you a big important question. What does the world need more of?
Wow. That is a great question. Okay, so the world needs more open hearts.
Mm.
And I say that because I see what a big difference it makes in my day when I walk through it with an open heart.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your story, the work you're doing, for teaching us, and for having an open heart throughout this conversation. It's been rewarding, and just a lot of new information has entered our brains in a good way. And I definitely want to go to Rwanda now. So thanks for that.
Oh, yeah. So by the way, I actually just loaded a new blog post up yesterday from our Three Mountains website. We have a Crop to Cup tour. So our next trip is January 2020. So the details are up on our website now, and that's open to 6 people to join my husband, Eddie, and I. So we have a great time, and I'm happy to share the details with anyone who's interested. And you guys have been amazing. Thank you so much for offering this platform for us to connect and create community.
Absolutely. And I'm repeating myself, but you know, we really are grateful for you and the work that you're doing. So thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.